In 1865, the slaves had been freed, but they were without political or civil rights. In the words of Frederick Douglass, unfriendly legislation could make our liberty a delusion, a mockery, and a snare. In many of the southern states, freedmen formulated petitions and resolutions setting forth their rights. The following are excerpts from such resolutions.
From a mass meeting in Norfolk, Virginia, May 1865. Resolved that personal servitude having been abolished in Virginia, it behooves us and is demanded of us by every consideration of right and duty to speak and act as free men, and as such to claim and insist upon equality before the law and equal rights of suffrage at the ballot box. From the Colored People's Convention of the State of South Carolina, November 1865. We simply ask that we shall be recognized as men, that there be no obstructions placed in our way, that the same laws which govern white men shall govern black men, that we have the right of trial by a jury of our peers, that schools be established for the education of colored children as well as white, and that the advantages of both colors shall, in this respect, be equal.
In 1866, the radical Republican-dominated Congress took control of Reconstruction policy from President Andrew Johnson, thereby initiating the era known as Congressional or Radical Reconstruction. Under military protection, the freedmen in the southern states received the right to vote, to hold office, and to organize for civil rights. Between 1867 and 1890, hundreds of Negroes were elected to state legislatures in the South. At South Carolina's Constitutional Convention of 1868, 76 of the 131 delegates were blacks. Their goals were expressed by the Reverend Richard Kane, one of the delegates.
I want a constitution that shall do justice to all men. I have no prejudices and feel above making any distinctions. I hope we will take hold high upon the highway of human progress. I want to see internal improvements, the railroads rebuilt, and in fact, the whole internal resources of the state so developed that she shall be brought back more happy and prosperous than she ever was.
In 1868, the Georgia legislature refused to seat 27 of its elected members because they were blacks. Senator Henry M. Turner delivered a forceful speech on his right to a seat, part of which follows.
Mr. Speaker! Before proceeding to argue this question upon its intrinsic merits, I wish the members of this House to understand the position that I take. I hold that I am a member of this body. Therefore, sir, I shall neither fawn nor cringe before any party, nor stoop to beg them for my rights. I am here to demand my rights and to hurl thunderbolts at the men who would dare to cross the threshold of my manhood. There are persons in this legislature today who are ready to spit their poison in my face. They question my right to a seat in this body, to represent the people whose legal votes elected me. This objection, sir, is an unheard-of monopoly of power. The great question, sir, is this. Am I a man? If I am such, I claim the rights of a man. Am I not a man because I happen to be of a darker hue than honorable gentlemen around me?
Between 1869 and 1877, 16 Negroes were elected to Congress. Richard Kane, representative from South Carolina, called for the passage of a Civil Rights Act in 1874.
Why not pass the Civil Rights Bill? I'm at a loss to understand the philosophy which these gentlemen have learned. How they can arrogate to themselves all rights, all liberty, all law, all government, all progress, all science, all arts, all literature, and deny them to other men formed of God equally as they are formed. Clothed with the same humanity and endowed with the same intellectual powers, but robbed by their connivance of the means of development. The Civil Rights Bill simply declares this, that there shall be no discriminations between citizens of this land so far as the laws of the land are concerned. The great living principle of the American government is that all men are free. We admit from every land and every nationality men to come here and repose in peace and protection. We assume that each man may aspire to and acquire all the rights of citizenship. Yet because, forsooth, God Almighty made the face of the Negro black, these gentlemen would deny him that right, though he be a man. And I want to say that we do not come here begging for our rights. We come here clothed in the garb of American citizenship. We come demanding our rights in the name of justice.
The disputed presidential election of 1876 signaled the end of the Reconstruction era. An agreement was reached by which the Republican, Rutherford B. Hayes, became president, and federal troops were withdrawn from the South. Laws to strip the black man of his political and civil rights were passed in the southern states. Confronted with violence and terror, the Negroes sought many different ways of ending their intolerable situation. For some, the solution was to leave their homes and migrate to northern states. In 1879, a Senate committee was appointed to investigate a mass migration from Louisiana to Kansas. Henry Adams, a former slave, testified.
We had much rather stayed in the South if we could have had our rights. In 1877, we lost all hopes. We found ourselves in such condition that we looked around and we see that there was no way on earth, it seemed, that we could better our condition there. We said that the whole South, every state in the South, had got into the hands of the very men that held the slaves. We thought that the men that held the slaves was holding the reins of government over our heads in every respect almost, even the constable up to the governor. We felt we had almost as well be slaves under these men.
Frederick Douglass, in a speech to the National Convention of Colored Men in Louisville in 1883, stressed the need for organization.
Who would be free, themselves must strike the blow. You know that liberty given is never so precious as liberty sought for and fought for. The man outraged is the man to make the outcry. If the 6 millions of colored people of this country, armed with the Constitution of the United States, with 1 million votes of their own to lean upon, and millions of white men at their back whose hearts are responsive to the claims of humanity, have not sufficient spirit and wisdom to organize and combine to defend themselves from outrage, discrimination, and oppression, it will be idle for them to expect that the Republican Party or any other political party will organize and combine for them or care what becomes of them. Men may combine to prevent cruelty to animals, for they are dumb and cannot speak for themselves. But we are men and must speak for ourselves, or we shall not be spoken for at all.
In 1887, an attempt was made to create an organization to pursue the battle for equality through the courts. The purpose of the Mutual United Brotherhood of Liberty was described by E.J. Waring, the first Negro lawyer in Baltimore.
They tell us we are free, that we are citizens, that we are under the protection of the law. It's a lie. They tell us justice is blind. It's a lie, for the blind goddess raises her bandage from the eyes to ascertain the race and color of those kneeling at her shrine before she dispenses law. I have the honor to be the counsel of an organization in my adopted city and state known as the United Brotherhood of Liberty. The purpose of the organization is to test in the courts infringement of the rights of colored people, whether as a race or as individuals. We should organize the country over, raise funds, and employ counsel. Then, if an individual is denied some right or privilege, let the race make his wrong their wrong and test the cause in law.
Booker T. Washington, founder of Tuskegee Institute, in his famous Atlanta Exposition speech in 1895, advised the Negro to forget about civil rights and social equality and to concentrate on economic advancement in cooperation with white business leaders.
A ship, lost at sea for many days, suddenly sighted a friendly vessel. From the mast of the unfortunate vessel was seen the signal. Water. Water, we die of thirst. The answer from the friendly vessel that once came back. Cast down your bucket where you are. A second time, the signal. Water, water, send us water, ran up from the distressed vessel and was answered. Cast down your bucket where you are. And a third and fourth signal for water was answered. Cast down your bucket where you are. The captain of the distressed vessel, at last heeding the injunction, cast down his bucket, and it came up full of fresh, sparkling water from the mouth of the Amazon River. To those of my race who depend on bettering their condition in a foreign land, or who underestimate the importance of cultivating friendly relations with the southern white man who is their next-door neighbor, I would say, cast down your bucket where you are. Cast it down in making friends in every manly way of the people of all races by whom you are surrounded. Cast it down in agriculture, in mechanics, in commerce, in domestic service, and in the professions. The wisest among my race understand that the agitation of questions of social equality is the extremest folly, and that progress in the enjoyment of all the privileges that will come to us must be the result of severe and constant struggle rather than of artificial forcing. It is important and right that all privileges of the law be ours, but it is vastly more important that we be prepared for the exercise of these privileges. The opportunity to earn a dollar in a factory just now is worth infinitely more than the opportunity to spend a dollar in an opera house.
Strong opposition to the policy enunciated by Booker T. Washington was expressed in a speech in 1896 by John Hope, president of Atlanta University.
If we are not striving for equality, in heaven's name, for what are we living? I regard it as cowardly and dishonest for any of our colored men to tell white people or colored people that we are not struggling for equality. If money, education, and honesty will not bring to me as much privilege, as much equality as they bring to any American citizen, then they are to me a curse and not a blessing. If we cannot do what other free men do, then we are not free. Yes, my friends, I want equality, nothing less. I want all that my God-given powers will enable me to get. Then why not equality? Now catch your breath, for I'm going to use an adjective. I'm going to say we demand social equality. If equality, political, economic, and social, is the boon of other men in this great country of ours, then equality, political, economic, and social, is what we demand. Why build a wall to keep me out? I am no wild beast, nor am I an unclean thing. Rise, brothers. Come, let us possess this land. Never say, let well enough alone. Be discontented. Be dissatisfied. Let your discontent break mountain high against the wall of prejudice and swamp it to the very foundation. Then we shall not have to plead for justice, nor on bended knee crave mercy, for we shall be men.
Some saw the struggle, however, not in terms of color, but of class. Influenced by the writings of Karl Marx and Henry George and by the agrarian reformers of the post-Civil War period, they presented the issue as one of workers struggling for justice against capitalism. The following are excerpts from a book by T. Thomas Fortune, published in New York in 1884. Fortune, born a slave, became editor of the New York Age.
When a society fosters as much crime and destitution as ours, with ample resources to meet the actual necessities of everyone, there must be something radically wrong, not in the society, but in the foundation upon which society is reared. Where is this ulcer located? Is it not to be found in the powerful monopolies we have created? The future struggle in the South will be not between white men and black men, but between capital and labor, landlord and tenant. The hour is approaching when the laboring classes of our country, North, East, West, and South, will recognize that they have a common cause, a common humanity, and a common enemy. And that, therefore, if they would triumph over wrong and place the laurel wreath upon triumphant justice without distinction of race or of previous condition, they must unite.
Again, a return to Africa was proposed as a solution to the problems the black people faced in America. In a speech in 1896, Henry M. Turner said,
"There is no manhood future in the United States for the Negro. He may eke out an existence for generations to come, but he can never be a man full, symmetrical, and undwarfed. I believe that 2 or 3 millions of us should return to the land of our ancestors and establish our own nation, civilization, laws, customs, style of manufacture, and not only give the world, like other race varieties, the benefit of our individuality, but build up social conditions peculiarly our own. What the black man needs is a country and surroundings in harmony with his color and with respect for his manhood."
Black and white farmers combined to support the populist movement of the early 1890s, which did establish a more progressive government in several states. But when these progressive governments were overthrown, there seemed to be no limits to the growing violence. 1,500 lynchings took place between 1885 and 1900. Negroes spoke out to call attention to the violence of the Ku Klux Klan and similar organizations. A New Orleans mass meeting in 1888 adopted the following statement.
"We citizens of New Orleans declare and assert that a reign of terror exists in many parts of the state, that the laws are suspended and the officers of the government, from the governor down, afford no protection to the lives and property of the people against armed bodies of whites who shed innocent blood and commit deeds of savagery unsurpassed in the dark ages of mankind. The press, the pulpit, the commercial organizations, and executive authority of the state have given both open and silent approval of all these crimes. In addition to these methods, there seems to be a deep-laid scheme to reduce the Negroes of the state to a condition of abject serfdom and peonage. It is being executed by armed bodies of men styling themselves regulators. These lawless bands make night hideous with their unblushing outrages and murders of inoffensive colored citizens. They go out on nightly raids, order peaceable citizens away never to return, whip some, fire into houses of others, endangering the defenseless lives of women and children, and no attempt is being made to indict them. No virtuous element in the state is found among the whites to rise up in their might and sternly repress these outrageous crimes."
In 1892, Frederick Douglass spoke on the responsibility for lynchings.
"Now where rests the responsibility for the lynch law prevalent in the South? It is evident that it is not entirely with the ignorant mob, the men who break open jails and with bloody hands destroy human life are not alone responsible. These are not the men who make public sentiment. They are simply the hangman, not the court, judge, or jury. They simply obey the public sentiment of the South, the sentiment created by wealth and respectability, by the press and pulpit. A change in public sentiment can be easily effected by these forces whenever they shall elect to make the effort. Let the press and the pulpit of the South unite their power against the cruelty, disgrace, and shame that is settling like a mantle of fire upon these lynch law states, and lynch law itself will soon cease to exist.
In 1899, the National Afro-American Council set aside a day of fasting and prayer as a protest against lynching, stating in its call,
"In many sections, we are arrested and lodged in jails on the most frivolous suspicion of being the perpetrators of most hideous and revolting crimes. And regardless of established guilt, mobs are formed of ignorant, vicious, whiskey-besotted men, at whose approach the keys of these jails and prisons are surrendered, and the suspicioned party is ruthlessly forced from the custody of the law and tortured, hanged, shot, butchered, dismembered, and burned in the most fiendish manner. These mobs no longer conceal themselves in the shadows of the night, but in open day plunder the prisons for the victims of their lawless vengeance and defiantly walk into courts and rob the sheriffs and judges of their prisoners and butcher them without even time to commune in prayer with God, a privilege that no barbaric age has ever denied a soul about to be ushered into the presence of his Maker."
Ida Wells began her campaign against lynching in Tennessee at the age of 19, when, in 1892, she published information showing that the lynching of three successful Negro grocers was the work of white competitors. Her press was wrecked, and she was driven from Memphis. In an article published in 1901, she exposed the falsity of the claim that lynchings were in response to the crime of rape.
It would be supposed that the record would show that all or nearly all lynchings were caused by outrageous assaults upon women. But the record makes no such disclosure. Instead, it shows that five women have been lynched, put to death with unspeakable savagery during the past 5 years. It shows that men, not a few, but hundreds, have been lynched for misdemeanors, while others have suffered death for no offense known to the law, the causes assigned being mistaken identity, insult, bad reputation, unpopularity, violating contract, running quarantine, giving evidence, frightening children by shooting at rabbits, etc.
During the last decade of the 19th century, the southern states increasingly passed Jim Crow laws designed to keep the black people separate from the white citizens. In 1896, in the case of Plessy versus Ferguson, the United States Supreme Court upheld a Louisiana statute requiring segregated railroad facilities, thus establishing the doctrine of separate but equal accommodations, which was to govern many aspects of American life until the middle of the 20th century. In a dissenting opinion, Justice John Marshall Harlan attacked racism as a denial of fundamental American principles.
"In view of the Constitution, in the eye of the law, there is in this country no superior, dominant, ruling class of citizens. There is no caste here. Our Constitution is colorblind and neither knows nor tolerates classes among citizens. In respect of civil rights, all citizens are equal before the law. The humblest is the peer of the most powerful. The law regards man as man and takes no account of his surroundings or of his color when his civil rights, as guaranteed by the supreme law of the land, are involved. The arbitrary separation of citizens on the basis of race, while they are on a public highway, is a badge of servitude wholly inconsistent with the civil freedom and the equality before the law established by the Constitution. It cannot be justified upon any legal grounds."
The Massachusetts branch of the Colored National League in 1899 addressed the following open letter to President McKinley.
"We address ourselves to you, sir, not as suppliants, but as of right, as American citizens. We have suffered, sir. God knows how much we have suffered since your accession to office. at the hands of a country professing to be Christian, but which is not Christian, from the hate and violence of the people claiming to be civilized, but who are not civilized. And you have seen our sufferings, witnessed from your high place our awful wrongs and miseries, and yet you have at no time and on no occasion opened your lips in our behalf. Why, we ask? Is it because we are black and weak and despised? Are you silent because, without any fault of our own, we were enslaved and held for more than two centuries in cruel bondage by your forefathers? The suppression, the terror wrought at the South is so complete, so ever-present, so awful, that no Negro's life or property is safe for a day who ventures to raise his voice to heaven in indignant protest and appeal against the deep damnation and despotism of such a social state. But if the silence of death reign over our people and their leaders at the South, we of Massachusetts are free and must and shall raise our voice to you and through you to the country in solemn protest and warning against the fearful sin and peril of such explosive social conditions.